Don't frighten us by telling us the facts. 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 We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on January 27th, 2019, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate and Rachel joined me to discuss the interesting or disappointing new congressional Dem committee appointments and other developments in the new Congress. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week is Nate. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
And on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Nate.
So we wanted to talk this week about some of the interesting things that some of the newer members of Congress have been up to. Some of these are first-termers, some of these are second-termers. This is from the Democratic side, obviously. You know, last week we were talking about the LA teacher strike, which the teachers ended up winning. That was very exciting news. Now we're looking at something that's maybe a little bit more uphill in some cases, but there's also been some positive news there as well. There were also a few things, though, that were not as positive, so we're going to be hitting a couple different angles there. The first thing we wanted to talk about was this PAYGO BS. The pay-as-you-go stuff, which I guess, like, you know, there's some back and forth on that because there's, like, the component that's, I guess, the rules within, like, that the Democrats get to impose if they're the leadership of the majority, which they kept and they shouldn't have, and we'll talk about that. And then I guess there's also just a law on the books that's supposed to be, but I mean, Congress makes the laws, so they can do whatever they want. But let's talk about that. I think that if you're like me and Nate and you've been, you know, in the Blago trenches for a stupid amount of time now at this
very
point, and you've followed all these procedural debates back and forth, you're also very frustrated by this PAYGO stuff, and have been for quite a while. This was the first sign that we were going to have a troubling reappearance of some of the bad decision-making of the last time that Pelosi and company were in the leadership. I think she did a good job for the most part the last time, but there were a bunch of, like, pretty huge mistakes that she made as the House Speaker that now that we have seen them fail, it seems extra stupid to repeat them. But let's talk about this. Rachel?
So the PAYGO rule is just basically if you want to increase spending, you have to cut spending somewhere else.
Or increase taxes, but they never do that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Raising taxes is always off the table, it seems like. There is a really good article on NewYorkMag.com. So it's just basically saying that it's this rule that the House just passed is substantively indefensible. It's just kind of invoking the magical words fiscal responsibility without really examining what that means for people. So if we are kind of hindering our efforts to pass, like, public welfare bills and social welfare bills, we're putting a stumbling block in front of our feet before even listening to, like, the opposition party and the arguments that they're going to bring up. So we're kind of doing their work for them. I think the argument that pundits like to pass around is, like, you can't deficit spend in your household budget. despite consumer credit being a thing. But it's trying to say that we should be running the government like a household, which is just a stupid argument. Public spending is super important. Passing these welfare bills, these social entitlement bills is super important, and the payout and in the human benefit far outweighs the financial cost. There's also a Vox.com explainer, and they included a quote from Stephanie Kelton, a progressive economist with Stony Brook University. The message Democratic leaders are sending is that we as a party, Democrats, stand for fiscal discipline. What I hear is that Democrats are willing to prioritize budget outcomes over human ones. So I think that really sums it up right there.
Yeah, and without even going full into like modern monetary theory, which is Kelton's thing, sort of, you know, it's basic macroeconomics where, you know, the country's budget is not the same as a household budget, and you need counter-cyclical spending.
That's like, why they call it macroeconomics and not like microeconomics.
Extremely basic stuff. So, like, the ability for people to not get it or to continually make this sort of comparison, which even Obama, didn't he make that comparison to? Got to tighten the belt, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, that's not really how it works. But
yeah, and I believe the New York Magazine article also pointed out how this PAYGO rule really hindered the Affordable Care Act negotiations. It just kind of put all these obstacles in our way, like how are we going to pay for it before we even got down to hammering out those details.
Oh yeah, that's right, I completely forgot this when we were doing the outline for this episode, but there was that, I forget who it was now, but somebody was saying, what's the problem with PAYGO, that's how we passed the ACA, and like as if that was a good example, which as you say is not a good example. It's an example of what the problem is. And, you know, I think I kind of replied sarcastically, but basically, like, the one of the biggest problems with the ACA from a political standpoint was that they front-loaded the financing. So there was a several-year period where instead of it just, you know, 6 months later or whatever going into effect, it was coming in these phases, but they were already starting to, you know, raise revenues and impose taxes and things like that to try to get a pool of money on hand so that everything would be paid for effectively, instead of, as I said, just kicking it into effect right away so that people would know what they were getting one way or the other out of it. Because the result of not having it go into effect, or the bulk of it not going into effect until the end of 2013 or even beginning of 2014, effectively, after it was passed at the beginning of 2010, meant that there was like 3 or 4 years of solid opportunity for the Republicans just to go to town on it and say that all these terrible things were going to happen. And then, of course, you know, if you had been building it up as a good thing in your head and then it kind of fell short of that, those expectations from the other direction, that also didn't help. So just politically, that was a disaster. And that was one of the consequences of like this obsession with the, you know, pay as you go stuff.
Right. I did want to point out it was the Vox.com article that kind of that pointed out the Affordable Care Act negotiations. And it kind of brought back the specter of the Blue Dog Democrat, which I had hoped to forget about forever, because they kind of really messed everything up during the ACA process.
Yeah, and there's not that many of them left. And as a reminder, as always, we'll have a PDF up on arsenalfordemocracy.com that has all the links to the various news articles we're talking about. Nate?
One thing I thought was interesting, and I didn't realize this at first because AOC and Ro Khanna had their names sort of attached to this, and I think Khanna like went back and forth on Twitter with like a Nancy Pelosi spokesperson or something. But I also saw Tim Ryan was also connected to this, and he's sort of, I don't know if he's technically a blue dog, but he's sort of a more centrist,
I think he's like an anti-abortion, you know,
right,
Rust Belt Democrat.
Yeah,
and I
so,
think he challenged Pelosi previously.
Right, so a little different than Khanna and Cortez, but he said critical investments in infrastructure, education, and healthcare should not be held hostage to budgetary constraints that Republicans have never respected. So, you know, he's sort of, it's, you know, at least some sort of interesting alliances here, but, you know, they're creating a situation where at least there's some pushback against it, but yeah, it's tough to see exactly what it's going to be like going forward.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, just to sort of recap this particular section, you know, the problem here is that, and they're still discussing potentially changing some things on this, you know, which is good, I guess. But like, just the fact that it didn't even seem to occur to them to like not put this into place, you know, just demonstrated that they hadn't really learned a lot of the key lessons that a lot of us learned from the last time that the Democrats had a majority in the House. And it makes it hard to do big bills. Like, it makes it hard to do Medicare for All or a Green New Deal or any of these things that are going to cost some money, especially up front. They may, you know, in the case of something like the Green New Deal, like, that's going to pay off enormously in the long run. It's an investment, so you're going to get a lot of money back. But if you have to prepay everything, you know, that's an absurd problem. And it just, it, you know, the question that, you know, that some people were raising was like, well, are they doing this because they're incompetent, or are they doing this because they're genuinely so deep in the like framework of how they think about these things, and that they also don't want those big ambitious pieces of legislation to even be possible? I don't really know. That's the thing that I always come back to with this, with the Democratic leadership in Congress, is that I think half of them are incompetent and half of them are like very cynical operators on behalf of capital. But like, there's a lot of them that I think it's some combination where they genuinely probably would like to do more ambitious things, but are also just so far up their like West Wing universe.
Right. They've convinced themselves that better things are not possible. So yeah. Why try?
Let's talk about some more positive things, though. There were some key committee appointments, especially on committees like financial services, House oversight. Let's talk about that. Who are some of the ones that we need to highlight here?
Well, there are two Democratic socialists now on the House Oversight Committee, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan are now joining the committee alongside progressives Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts and Ro Khanna of California. So I think it's really awesome that three freshman representatives are now on this very important committee. So I think it's hopeful to see that the Democrats, who kind of historically have been really terrible about growing the leadership for the future, it's really encouraging to see all these young people getting these pretty plum committee appointments.
Yeah, I think you had an article here that was saying that this might help with, like, because there's been a lot of people who don't like AOC throwing the term backbencher around. And this article that you had here from the New York Magazine, I think, was arguing that you know, it's good to have backbenchers getting positions like this to give them some training and experience and build up for the future when they're probably not going to be backbenchers. I mean, I think it would shock most people if AOC remains a backbencher for the rest of her career.
Considering that this is not a parliamentary system and all representatives are basically equal, to call someone a backbencher, especially when she has the amount of media spotlight that she does in comparison to any other congressperson, is kind of unfair. But I did actually see this Intercept article where I think she was trying to get on Ways and Means, and instead Democrats put on Tom Suozzi, is a new Democrat from Long Island and a little bit of Queens. So he got the seat instead of her, but he's a sophomore congressman. So it's not like he has really that much of a seniority argument, but thought that was interesting.
Other highlights from various appointments?
I did want to point out that Ayanna Pressley is also on the Financial Services Committee. And there was an interview in the Boston Globe. They asked her what she's hoping to do on this committee. She said, it will allow me to build upon work that I've already been doing on the municipal level on that space, consumer protection, tackling student debt, affordable housing crisis. And the thing I'm most excited about is to keep Ben Carson in my sightline. He has all but abandoned public housing. I have one of the largest housing developments in the country. And something she kept going back to in this interview is how she was tying it what she plans on doing to her congressional district. She pointed out that her district has the largest concentration of college students in the country, and student debt is crippling and handicapping dreams and the full contributions that so many people hope to make. It is a national crisis. And also, she wanted to address the wealth and wage inequities and disparities in housing. So mitigating the impacts of redlining, which has contributed for generations to the wealth gap. So I think that's just the way she's very media savvy. She wants to reach out to her constituency in a very material sense and address some of these inequalities that are most affecting her district.
Yeah, and I live in her district, and just for a bit of context, as she's talking about the impacts of redlining and the wealth gap, things like that, the average net wealth of a non-immigrant Black family in Boston, in particular, I think her district, is $8. And that came out, I think, Boston Globe a couple months ago. But so yeah, we're seeing pretty stark racial disparities.
And she's been pointing out, you know, that there are the disparity factor is huge in this district and really highlighted, because you go from those very poor areas of Boston or very poor areas, even I think in, if I remember correctly, what the district is on the north side of the district. And then in between, you've got like pretty wealthy areas of Cambridge and so forth that, you know, you can have lifespan differences of 30 years and so forth. So it is really stark. And as Rachel points out, you know, she's able to tie back all these different financial issues to a lot of that as well. So that's definitely really exciting news. I mean, she's an extraordinarily talented politician. Other appointments that you wanted to talk about, I think Congressman Jayapal from Washington had one as well, Rachel. She's not a freshman though. She's second term.
She is now the new co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which is 40% of the Democrats in the House are part of this caucus. And I think she's putting together a Medicare for All bill. It's still in the draft stages. And I think a lot of people are kind of concerned with how it's going to shake out. They're worried that she's going to weaken some of the language in this bill. So I've seen a few different calls to petition her to keep really strong Medicare for All language in the bill. House Speaker Pelosi is supporting holding hearings on the bill, which is kind of a change from past terms, I believe.
There were some negatives in terms of appointments to various things, in particular in the realms of energy and the environment, both on the House side and the Senate side. Obviously, I'm guessing that people a few weeks ago had seen the stuff about the Green New Deal stuff, the Select Committee thing kind of getting watered down and having a pretty energy industry, fossil energy industry friendly person being appointed to chair that committee. Not necessarily a huge shock, still disappointing. But the another possibly worse development has come on the Senate side of things. Nate, I guess you wanted to talk about some of those.
Yeah, no, this popped up recently. Reported that, I guess Greenwire reported that the U.S. Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources hired a former fracking lobbyist to lead the minority staff. So Sarah Venuto Perez was formerly a federal lobbyist for America's Natural Gas Alliance, ANGA, merged into the American Petroleum Institute, and is a leader for advocating for hydraulic fracturing for natural gas and shale basins.
And I guess my understanding of this is that the part of the reason that she got that job is because she had been previously, before being a lobbyist, had been a staffer for Joe Manchin, I think. And
before that was in the Office of General Counsel for Hillary 08, and then donated a lot of money to Hillary 2016 as a lobbyist.
And Joe Manchin, his leadership of energy and natural resources is itself a controversy, and there were quite a few articles about that. I mean, it's just absolutely terrible. He ran for Senate the first time in 2010 with a video of himself shooting the cap and trade bill with a gun. which is a very pretty cool. mild bill. Yeah, and you know, he's one of these people that's sort of just delusionally or falsely promising a restoration of the coal industry, which is not going to happen, but also is not helpful for the direction that we need to be going. And this is just sort of a hugely bad signal. And now there were various other Democrats that passed over the opportunity, including independent in the caucus, Bernie Sanders, and he got some flack for that. But of course, he wasn't even the first in line, and he didn't want to give up the important role that he had, I think, on the budget committee, which is, you know, also hugely important for, you know, passing climate change type legislation, you know, especially if it went to reconciliation or something like that. Not that it's going to happen under this Senate, but, you know, just various strategic steps, because who knows where he's going to be in the next Senate term if they win back a majority. He, you know, assuming that he's still in the Senate as opposed to the White House. But yeah, so somehow after several people passed it up, it went to Joe Manchin based on seniority, and that's just absolutely awful. I guess, again, maybe not surprising, definitely disappointing, not very encouraging for the future of things. Going back to some positive things, although again on the front of not shocked but disappointed, was folks like AOC and some other people highlighting some things that were, you know, business as usual practices that probably shouldn't be business as usual practices. Rachel, did you want to talk a little bit about that briefly? I don't know that there's a whole lot to cover on it because it's probably been covered most other places by now, but this is like an orientation type thing.
Right. So she tweeted December 6th of last year, right now freshman members of Congress are at a quote-unquote bipartisan orientation with briefings on issues. Invited panelists offer insights to inform new Congress members' views as they prepare to legislate. Number of corporate CEOs we've listened to here, 4. Number of labor leaders, 0. And she followed that up with another tweet. Our bipartisan congressional orientation is co-hosted by a corporate lobbyist group. Other members have quietly expressed to me their concern that this wasn't told to us in advance. Lobbyists are here. Goldman Sachs is here. Where's labor? Activists. Frontline community leaders. So I think,
and even the content of the presentations, wasn't it a lot of stuff like you don't know what you're getting in for, and you got to learn how to play ball and stuff. Brought to you by Goldman Sachs or whatever.
And wasn't this at Harvard too? It was like the Kennedy School.
So not even in D.C.
Yeah.
Right. No. And I think they talk a lot about how much time is taken up by fundraising. I think that's something that's not very well known. Just how much time. People are expected to take to get on the phones with major donors and just kind of just sell themselves for money pretty much. So I think she's doing a really good job of shining a spotlight on these, like, basically open secrets in DC. And that if you're not an insider or not like a politics wonk, you're probably not aware of. So I think, like I said before, these freshman Congress people are very media savvy. They know how to communicate with their constituents as well as everybody across the world, across the country, about these issues. And I think that makes opposing them very hard because they're taking their message straight to the people, and it can't get diluted by the mainstream media.
Yeah, I mean, between the time that she won the primary in June and the time, you know, that she got sworn in, I kept on wondering what was going to happen in terms of the, you know, DCCC and the endless fundraising and stuff, because that's something that I was aware of, is that, you know, a lot of these members of Congress, they get elected and then are forced by the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, to go sit in a, like, dimly lit basement in a cubicle flipping through a binder and calling up random people asking them for $5,000 or whatever. My understanding previously, and I guess it's kind of a, you know, shows how dependent a lot of these members were on the sort of party infrastructure and stuff, was that no one was, for the most part, I don't think, if anybody, was really even refusing this pattern. I mean, maybe there were starting to be a couple of people in the last term that I don't know of. But, like, as far as I can tell, she has not been doing that. As far as I can tell, maybe there's also some other members, I don't know. It seems like she doesn't really have to do that to fundraise because her money's just rolling in on its own through small dollar donations because people like her and she's in the media constantly. I don't think she's sitting there in a basement flipping through a binder or whatever. I have no firsthand knowledge one way or the other, but most relatable thing that she's done as a millennial in our cohort peer group, you know, who was in college at the same time as us, is that she's using all her free time of not having to raise money from big donors to just post on Twitter.
Or go on Twitch streams.
Yeah, or go on Twitch streams. Yeah, at this point, like, she's not even raising money for herself. She's going on a Twitch stream to raise money for a trans activist group in the United Kingdom because someone asked her to. Like, that's super cool. And she wouldn't be able to do that if she was raising money from
the big donors. She's a big N64 fan, wants to bring back Pokemon Snap. So Pokemon Snap on Switch. Let's get it done.
And also she's posting like videos on Instagram where she's like cooking in her kitchen pretty much and just talking to people.
Which sparked a trend
answering questions.
All of the other people that are running for president, like Elizabeth Warren's drinking beer in her kitchen and cooking, and like Beto is getting his teeth cleaned.
Senator Harris from California
dancing to Cardi B.
Yeah,
was doing the Wakanda pose.
She was doing the Wakanda pose. She was dancing to Cardi B in front of her Wi-Fi password and network information at her office, which I just, what are you doing? I thought, like, it's 2019. That's a mistake you make in 2008. Like,
well, she hired Hillary's Iowa person to be
cool.
on her like, campaign.
And then, as one of our friends of the show, who shall remain unnamed, keeps on just tweeting the one line from one of her videos where she said that one of the musical groups that she was into was Salt and Pepper. And so he just keeps tweeting Salt and Pepper and then laughing hysterically, as opposed to the band Salt and Pepper. If you really want to get technical about how to say that, as opposed to Salt and Pepper. Anyway, so that's where we're at on that. Everyone, I guess, wants to be AOC at this point, but there aren't a lot of people that are as effortless about it as she is. All right, that's sort of our update on what's going on with Congress. We've got another episode coming up soon for you, should be next week. And then our intention at the moment is to continue doing episodes throughout the spring, at least, so to the end of May. As folks know, I'm currently running for office up here. We're trying not to talk about it on the show, but like just letting you know that that's why that affects our schedule. So we're going to try to keep going on that for, 15 or so more episodes at this point. Stay tuned for that. Nate, thanks for being here in studio this week.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Rachel.
And Rachel, thanks for being on the line.
Thanks, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.